creation and evolution have occurred. So that has already been settled, because in the chapter on rebirth, he has established this as the purpose, one may say, of individual existence. Now the question that arises is, how did this condition arise, and what is it that drove this purpose? And he has already established in the previous chapter that it is a supreme reality and a supreme person that has become both cosmos and individual. Cosmos as the ground of manifestation, and individual as the form of evolving manifestation of the person. Or one may say cosmos as the manifestation of the supreme reality principle, and individual as the manifestation of the infinity or infinite possibilities of the supreme divine person. But he is now taking up other possible theories, because the question can arise, can it be any other way? So just given the fact that we are not aware of any other reality than the material one, but that we can observe a certain evolution here, both an evolution of form and an evolution of consciousness, there are two possibilities. One is that there is already a pre-existing plane of consciousness that has entered into, involved itself in this world, in this in conscience, and therefore exists separately and simultaneously with this world of inconscience, guiding its evolution, one may say. And the other, that there is no such separate superconscient world or plane, but that consciousness arises in out of an inconscience. Somehow it arises out of an inconscient, so that consciousness may be said to be a possibility latent within the inconscient, but not separate from it, simultaneously forming another plane somewhere. So in either of these cases, there are only two realities. It's a dualistic idea. There is either the reality of superconscience or the reality of inconscience, or both of them. And these two realities are like binary states. There is nothing in between them. So there is a plunge, an abrupt plunge out of superconscience into inconscience, or there is just an existing consciousness within the inconscient. These are the possibilities he's taking up. Now, if there is a plunge and if there is this kind of binary situation, it is evidently due to some kind of a desire, some kind of a, one may say, imagination. A mind activity, an activity of an idea that changes the state. There is a certain idea and there is a certain state of consciousness, so we move from this to the idea. This is an operation of mentality. So either this is a mind-conceived conception. And by mind, he will take up the possibility it may be a universal mind, or it may be an individual mind, or a group of individuals with minds, or mind creators, or mind creations. Or it is just an evolution out of inconscience through accident, as in the scientific idea, the materialistic idea, arising to a point where consciousness emerges but doesn't have any issue.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I think, you know, roughly he has introduced these kinds of parameters, and where we are right now, we can continue from this point with that background.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Could you explain if there is a real difference between the word plane and the word world? Do they mean pretty much the same thing, or is one an mixture of different forms of the other?
No, there is a difference when we use these terms. Idea of a plane of consciousness means that there is a certain kind of consciousness spread out as a universal possibility. We also sometimes Sri Aurobindo uses the term principle of consciousness. So principle of consciousness, which has a certain spatial manifestation, is a plane of consciousness. But a plane of consciousness may be just a certain outspread, you know, form. You see, just like the sky. We talk about the sky as a sort of a neutral sort of container of the entire universe, or whatever you want to call it. Now, however, this plane of consciousness may also harbor forms of consciousness. Now, if it harbors forms of itself, forms of consciousness, these forms must be related to each other, following laws set up by the principle of consciousness in that plane. This order of objects, of forms, in a plane of consciousness constitutes a world of consciousness. So, world implies that there is a manifestation that is held together by the laws of that plane of consciousness. Plane does not necessarily imply manifestation, but implies spatial existence. And by space, I don't mean physical space. I mean spiritual or philosophical space, that there is some space somewhere, whether in material world or in subtle worlds, a space exists where such a principle of consciousness is manifested, but without any forms to it. And principle of consciousness implies that that particular consciousness needn't even have any spatial manifestation.
Beautiful. Thank you, Devashita.
So, is there a difference between this special existence that you referred to with the potential of manifestation, meaning which has not been manifest yet?
Yeah, no, ask me, can you come with that question again? Is there a difference between what and what?
The plane that you referred to as a special existence, you use that term.
Yeah, spatial.
Yeah.
That is, it occupies space.
Oh, spatial, I see, not special. Spatial
no.
existence. Okay,
yeah,
even in that case, spatial existence, you are giving some kind of reality to that, right? By
yes.
referring to that spatial existence.
Yes.
And what is the difference with that, with the potential things that have not been manifested?
Yeah, that is the principle. So to say, for example, even prior to the spatial existence, there may be a principle which is unmanifest. So as soon as it manifests as the possibility of a world, it becomes like a container. So for example, this is the distinction, the question you're raising is actually a very important one, because it is related to the distinction between universe and transcendence. Transcendent Satchidananda reality has infinite potential to it. So that infinite potential might lie locked up and never manifest itself at all. If it wants to manifest itself, it must first manifest its possibility spatially. That is, it becomes a ground of some kind. That ground is a latent ground of objects or of forms, forms of itself, self-formations. But that self-extension, what Sri Aurobindo calls self-extension, is the beginning of cosmos.
Before the extension, what term you used? The possibility is what?
Unmanifest possibility of manifestation.
So is there a step between unmanifest and the later one? I forgot again the term that you used.
Self-extension.
Self-extension and unmanifest. Is there a step in between?
Yeah, it is. The step is actually that this question is very pertinent to this chapter, because this is exactly what he'll bring up. There is a step in between. That step in between is the will of manifestation. It's the Shakti. Shakti is the step in between. The step in between is an act of consciousness by Chit Shakti.
So, the will that already exists, is that something that you somehow refer to as a special existence?
The will manifests the special existence, brings out of manifestation into first the special existence and then into formations.
So the will cannot be called as plane of consciousness. Is when it actually becomes special existence, then only it can be called as plane of consciousness?
Yes.
Thank you.
Should we start?
Yes.
Was Jyoti going to read the first paragraph?
Yes, I can do. Okay. On that supposition, or on any of them, there could be only two planes of existence. On one side, there is the material universe created out of the inconscient by the blind nescience of force or nature. Beg your pardon. Okay, I'm going to start that again. On one side, there is the material universe created out of the inconscient by the blind nescience of force or nature, obedient perhaps to some inner unfelt self, which governs its somnambulist activities. On the other side, there is the superconscient one to which we return out of the inconscience and ignorance. Or else we may imagine that there is one plane only, the material existence. There is no superconscient apart from the soul of the material universe. If we find that there are other planes of conscious being, and that there already exist other worlds than the material universe, these ideas might become difficult to substantiate. But we can escape from that annulment if we suppose that these worlds have been subsequently created by or for the evolving soul in the course of its ascent out of the inconscience. In any of these views, the whole cosmos would be an evolution out of the inconscient, either with the material universe as its sole and sufficient stage and scene, or else with an ascending scale of worlds, one evolving out of the other, helping to grade our return to the original reality. Our own view has been that the cosmos is a self-graded evolution out of the superconscious Sachidananda, but in this idea, it would be nothing but an evolution of the inconscious towards some kind of knowledge sufficient to allow, by the annihilation of some primal ignorance or some originating desire, the extinction of a misbegotten soul or an escape out of adventure, mistaken world adventure.
Actually, I think we had done this paragraph last time, and essentially what he's referring to there is that when he says it is our own view has been that the cosmos is a self-created evolution, he's referring back to what he has already proposed in the previous chapter, that the involution is an act of spirit, and that first this act of spirit is accomplished through a series of planes of descent, and then this evolution the planes already exist. It is just as we start with the notion that a superconscious already exists. Intermediate planes between the superconscious and the inconscient also already exist in the very process of the plunge of the spirit. Now, this is to talk about it in temporal terms, in other words, as a process. But we should realize from the very beginning that to talk about it as a process is already a representation. It's the figure, because in eternity, processes are only figures or representations. Therefore, we have to say that such a process is again an eternal process, a process in which all these planes of consciousness that he's talking about, descending and ascending from superconscient to inconscient, are always present. And that is, in fact, one of the points he's making, that it is not a sudden, abrupt change of state from superconscient to inconscient, and then a climbing back to superconscient, and in the process of the evolution, creating these other worlds, intermediate worlds. That is one of the possibilities. Or the other, where there is no superconscient, but some kind of consciousness arising in the inconscient is trying to escape or break out of its prison, and thereby experiencing other forms of consciousness like life and mind. So either we have a situation in either case of other forms of consciousness, other worlds, one may say, not having any real reality or any independent reality, but dependent on the inconscient and the evolution of consciousness from the inconscient. To properly get our perspective on this chapter, one of the things to realize is that he's marshalling a certain number of arguments that exist as possibilities in the common mind, philosophical and spiritual mind, one set of which have to do with this notion of the existence of two real planes, or maybe one real plane. In both cases, it is either a duality, or it is an apparent duality. So this set of scenarios that exist, where we find ourselves in an inconscient world, but we have to somehow sort of extinct this inconscient or sort of erase this inconscient condition. It is only a condition of consciousness, an avastha. And we'll find ourselves in the superconscient condition. This is one possibility. Or on the other hand, there is nothing other than the inconscient, and it is better to find some solution either by the extinction of consciousness itself or by developing some kind of a permanence within the inconscient. Can an inconscient immortality or a material immortality be obtainable through powers of life itself, or powers of mind, which are present on the earth itself, not coming to it from elsewhere? So these possibilities that are present in the kind of common mind regarding trajectories of consciousness are what he's taking up. The other things that he'll take up will concern whether this is an individual fantasy, whether it is a fantasy of the mind, whether individual or cosmic, okay, or a fantasy of a number of souls jointly entered into this state, or whether the truth that we are experiencing in living.
It seems we can't hear clearly. Is anybody else experiencing this problem?
Last part of it,
hello, Albert? Yeah,
he's fake. Was there any cutter? Yes, there is. Just the last part of it.
Oh, I see. Hello, can you hear me? Hello, Peter?
Yeah, this is a broken LED. In most of, even though the philosophy is asserted that individual finding a solution will be a solution for all, because the individual identified with the cosmos, right? If they make that assertion, for example, in Buddha's case, his entire quest was, okay, is there a solution to these problems? And he went on that journey, and individual's quest resulted in a kind of upliftment in all those things, right?
No, upliftment, you mean, did it result in a change of the cosmic ignorance?
Yes.
It did not result in any change of cosmic ignorance. In fact, he was saying that cosmic, so-called cosmic ignorance does not even exist. It doesn't exist. You are experiencing it, but that is an illusion. So individual can find a solution to it. If you ask the question, what will happen to the rest of the world if I find a solution? Buddhism will say it doesn't matter because it doesn't even exist.
It is a part of the philosophy basically which wishes away the problem.
Exactly. It provides an individual solution, all right, but it wishes away the cosmic problem. Cosmic problem doesn't exist. Or it may say that if all individuals, you see the thing about multiple number comes in, why? Because if you're saying that solution can be found for an individual, and if every individual repeats that in their lives, then the problem will disappear. Because they will, this problem will cease to be, is a finite number of individuals, each soul will actually experience it, and then the stage will be cleared. The stage will, the state of experience will not exist anymore. But Aurobindo is essentially saying that state of experience is independent of individuals. That cosmos will not change. It doesn't matter how many individuals go through this particular process. Cosmos will not change until we find a cosmic solution. Actually, this subtle argument is related to his notion of bringing down the soma. In other words, supramental change has to be a change at the universal or cosmic level. It cannot just be a change at the individual level.
But individual is the link between the cosmic, he is cosmos also, right? So individual change can result in that. Can we think of
it? Yeah, it can. Of course, you're right, it can. He will go through that, but there are conditions. Conditioned individual can know identity with cosmos and with that from which cosmos has arisen. So, if the identity is achieved, then the answer is yes. But that means that that identity has become cosmos and individual and has become this evolving. You see, ultimately it boils down to that. It is not individual or cosmos that will. From the materiality as cosmos and individual, which has become. Now, if we take that to be the truth, then number of consequences follow, and that is what he is going through. Part of which has to do with the order of the worlds. That's what he is talking about. That the so-called worlds don't arrive inconstant. That they are always present. They are part.
Can't hear you, Vishishta.
So I'm saying that the idea of identity of self, cosmos, and individual is something which is ultimately it's part his integral framework. But it is also very important because it establishes the reality of the order of the worlds, which is what he's talking about here. Is there a graded self-evolution and a graded self-evolution simultaneously going on? Are these graded planes something already existent? I mean, are they a condition of existence itself? Or are they phenomena that arise temporally for some evolution to superconscient or to whatever? That is the real question.
I'm having trouble hearing Devashish. I don't know if anyone else is.
Hello?
Yeah, we have been having trouble too. I don't think the restarting just the Bashishda's call didn't help. Maybe we should restart everyone and try once.
Okay. You can do that.
At this point, I think it's better we start reading because a lot of these ideas that we are discussing will automatically come up as we are reading.
Sitaram, you want to read?
Yes.
Okay.
but such theories either imply a premier importance and originating power of mind, or a premier importance of individual being. Both have indeed a great place, but the one eternal spirit is the original power and the original existence. Idea, conceptually creative, not the real idea, which is being aware of what is in itself and automatically self-creative by the force of that awareness, is a movement of the mind. Desire is a movement of life in the mind, life in mind. Life and mind then must be pre-existent powers and must have been the determinants of the creation of the material world. And in that case, they can equally create worlds of their own supraphysical nature. Or else, we must suppose that what acted was not desire in an individual or a universal mind or life, but a will in the spirit, a will of being deploying something of itself or of its consciousness, realizing a creative idea or a self-knowledge or an urge of its self-active force, or a turn to a certain formulation of its delight of existence. But if the world has been created not by the universal delight of existence, but for the desire of the individual soul, its caprice of an ignorant egoistic enjoyment, then the mental individual and not the cosmic being or a transcendent divinity should be the creator and witness of the universe. In the past trend of human thought, the individual being has always loomed enormously large in the front plan of things and in the premier dimensions of importance. If these proportions could still be maintained, this origination might conceivably be admitted. For a will towards the life of the ignorance, or an ascent to it in the individual purusha, must indeed be part of the operative movement of consciousness in the involutionary descent of spirit into material nature. But the world cannot be a creation of the individual mind or a theater erected by it for its own play of consciousness. Nor can it have been created solely for the play of the satisfaction or frustration of the ego. As we awake to a sense of the premier importance of the universal and the dependence of the individual upon it, a theory of this kind becomes an impossibility to our intelligence. The world is too vast in its movement for such an account of its working to be credible. Only a cosmic power or a cosmic being can be the creator and the upholder of cosmos, and it must have too a cosmic and not only an individual reality's significance or purpose.
So here he's taking up those two aspects or possibilities, one being a mind created condition of abrupt sort of plunge into this condition of inconscience and the evolution out of it. and the other an individual choice, whether a choice of a single individual or the choice of some group individual. See, an individual being out of whom a multiplicity of individuals emerges. In either of these cases, mind you, you have to take these cases, each of these cases as independent, not as something which is already a self-formulation of something supreme or something absolute, but a partial reality, a partial independent reality. So if it is a question of mind, and there he is drawing the distinction between conceptive idea and real idea. In the case of supermind, he has talked about real idea. Real idea is so called because it is not something which is imagined that does not exist. It is already existent. Every possibility is a possibility of the self. It is only a self formation out of its own possibilities. While conceptive creation is a creation of a state that is not present in any realized form. It is sought to be realized. And that is the distinction between mind creation and supermind creation. That's why he's talking about idea, either as real idea or a conceptive idea. So it is if it is a conceptive idea, then this conceptive idea must be created by some sort of mind, a universal mind, let's say. And it must have been created due to some sort of desire in the mind. And so he is talking about two principles which are active in that case, both the principle of mind and the principle of life. Life and mind which is, you know, giving the notion of idea, and life which is giving the notion of desire within that mind, is then the primary creators of this condition. So he's saying if we take that to be the case, then these creators should have created mind worlds and life worlds outside of the material world. We cannot assume that there is only a material world in which they will plunge and then have this kind of existence. They must have mind worlds, or they can create other supraphysical worlds as well. There is no primacy to a material world as a theater or place of rebirth and evolution, so to say. The second possibility he is taking is that of the individual. Instead of the principle of an ideative consciousness, that is mind, urged by desire property of life, he's taking up the possibility of individual, either single or a bunch of individual souls that have made this choice, one may say, of entry into this kind of a condition. And there he's saying that the problem with that kind of idea is that it is okay to say that so long as we are not clear enough about the tremendously complex interdependent nature of the universe. It's interesting that he brings up that kind of an argument, because interestingly that kind of argument is not brought up in the Indian spiritual tradition, which is primarily individualistic in that sense. But in today's world, we are in a better position to appreciate that notion of interdependence, particularly in the material world itself, due to developments of disciplines such as ecology and other sort of holistic thinking, systems thinking forms, which allow us to become very clear about the tremendously delicate interdependence that maintains the biosphere. So, universe as an independent reality comes to mind here, and he's saying it becomes increasingly clear as we awake to a sense of the premier importance of the universal and the dependence of the individual upon it, that a theory which gives preponderance to individual will in creating this condition through which we find ourselves experiencing is not very credible. Only a cosmic power or a cosmic being can be the creator and upholder of the cosmos, and it must too have a cosmic and not only an individual reality significance of purpose.
Devashishtha, can you comment about the heaven, which is sometimes portrayed as the desired world? Can you comment on the concept of heaven, which is portrayed in mythology?
Yeah, well, heaven, can you explain what kind of heaven you're talking about? The heavens of desire?
Yeah, heavens of desire, essentially, where there is no doubt of, there is no problem of old age.
Yeah, as you see that as he's brought out over here, there are mind worlds and life worlds with their own kinds of laws. And these laws have their own independence. As he's pointing out over here, mind world has the law of conception. So it can conceive of various possibilities of existence without realizing them. It can cast them into forms which either are just mental forms, conceptive forms, or try to realize themselves in other forms of consciousness, like material forms or life forms, but are alien to those particular kinds of consciousness. That's why they remain, in some sense, sort of not self-realizations. Similarly, you can have life worlds following a life principle, which are, as he says over here, driven by the laws of desire, but not, you see again, not subject to material or mental principles or powers. They operate in a very different way from the laws of life manifesting in the material in conscience. And so these are sometimes known as the heaven worlds. Of course, there may be life worlds which are of a, what we might call, of pleasurable experiences. So those are considered to be the higher life worlds, what Sri Aurobindo has called the life heavens. And that's what you're talking about in terms of the mythologies. Or you may have unpleasant experiences in these life worlds too. And these are what one might call the hell worlds, the worlds in which there are experiences of pain and suffering that are experienced by the, condition of desire in that particular world. When I talk about condition of desire, I'm not talking about karma. I'm talking about the desire to experience those kinds of vital sort of experiences. And therefore, capacity and form of experience of many kinds can be realized at the life plane in these life worlds.
Devashishji, what is then Hiranyaloka?
Hiranyaloka. Hiranyaloka.
Yes, sorry, yes.
Hiranyaloka, etc., these are heaven worlds. And you see, heaven worlds, when we are talking about heaven worlds, normally the notion of Vedic notion of heaven worlds means the mind worlds, according to Sri Aurobindo. But these mind worlds rise to a point where they merge into overmind and then into supermind. Now, Hiranyaloka is more properly, I mean, of course, if you talk about supramental world as being golden world, world of golden consciousness, you might think of it as Hiranyaloka. But to my mind, it is more like the overmind that is spoken of in Hiranya, in talking about Hiranyaloka. Because even notion of Hiranyagarbha, womb of universe, is the cosmic consciousness, the cosmic world, out of which this entire manifestation, you know, emanates. So,
thank you.
The Vashistha says that shloka in Isha Upanishad, Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasyapihitam Mukham. So there also he says about that golden lid on the overmind, right?
Yes.
Similar
yes.
to Jyoti's question.
Yes. Golden lid of the overmind that stands between the vidya and the avidya.
If one actually is there, one still has to make the effort to get into supermind. Is that right?
If you're talking about these overmind planes, etc., it is not so much. I mean, the question of effort and meaning of effort is completely different over there. But yes, one has to move further if one wants to call it that. One has to progress even further from there.
So I have a question.
Yes.
You said meaning of effort is different. So what is the difference till over man, mind and about that?
Well, when we talk about effort, we think about effort in terms of our limited experience, which is based on the ego. It is a separative condition. And we make an effort, but the effort is something which we conceive of with the mind as something desirable, as a goal. I'm talking not desirable in terms of worldly profit, I'm talking about spiritual goal also. That we make an effort, in other words, we practice certain kinds of disciplines, etc. But gradually, notion of effort becomes something more akin to tuning ourselves to specific kinds of wills that already exist. In other words, can we, you know, unite ourselves through an effort or an intensity of aspiration with a certain universal goal? That becomes more the nature of effort. So the idea of effort changes. And it becomes more a question of yoga, union with higher consciousnesses and powers of will through a certain kind of a tuning of the aspiration, tuning of the, which also becomes more and more universal as one proceeds in this particular kind of yoga and process.
Yavishish.
Yes.
In that analogy of the golden lid, what would it be the supermind? Would it be the lid itself? Or
no, what is beyond the lid
would be the supermind.
Yes, the lid has to be removed, as it were. And it okay. is actually, one may say a reference to that lid that is being made when, you have that famous statement of the mother, where she talks about breaking the golden door that separated this world from the supermind. And I believe that that's the very same lid that she's talking about. which actually, you know, you see, we may put it another way in terms of practical reality, that whatever this supramental consciousness was latent and involved in the earth consciousness and present outside it as an unmanifest pressure, not as something which was already a principle active within the manifestation, earthly manifestation. But breaking this golden door in a cosmic way, again, not an individual way, that's how the mother puts it, would result in a kind of a different action of that same plane of consciousness.
That she said using the supreme will?
Yes.
But I think in that same...
Yes, it is. And then, but note, when we are talking about effort, that statement of the mother is very very interesting also. If somebody has it, we should consider it from the viewpoint of phenomenology to see what kind of experience she is describing there. Because she is describing an experience in which she, as an individual, unites or knows herself, her identity, with the transcendent principle and wills from there. So the willing is a recognition of a higher willing, not a willing from a lower plane, as it were, aiming at something higher. It is like a discovery rather than a attempt.
Well, thank you.
She uses the phrase, I knew and willed at the same time, if you remember that particular passage, I knew and willed at the same time that the time, I knew and that the time had come, she says, you know, that knowledge is not something that she has sort of, you know, thought about, but it is through identity that she knows that this is the moment, as it were, and this is the power.
So, can we say that when overmind is reached, surrender is complete, and that's why effort is done by divine and not by individual or ego?
No, it is actually difficult to even say that, because overmind is the world of the gods, and in a way, the gods don't necessarily have the power of surrender. Gods can know identity with the cosmos or with the cosmic principle. In other words, each of them experience themselves as the cosmic reality itself in a certain form. But at the same time, they are limited by that form. In other words, they have to accept the condition of the cosmos. See? Now, to go beyond that, one needs to surrender to the principle that is beyond that. And individual, at the human plane, that's why he's talking about the psychic being, the power of surrender of the psychic reality in the overmind can take it beyond to something higher.
Okay, thank you.
Debashita, I have the quote, so I'll just put it in the chat window, then you can read it and explain it also.
All right.
Debashishji, I was going back to the subject of Hiranyaloka.
Yes.
And I have read it said that inhabitants of that world have usually to work out causal karma. Would you be able to comment on that?
Yeah, it's difficult, Jyoti, to make comments on these kinds of things because they are so far and they tend to become sort of speculative. If experience is not sufficient to kind of warrant these kind of discussions or explanations, and I can certainly not, you know, kind of make any claim to any experience of any nature close to things of that kind, causal plane, etc. Technically speaking, causal plane is known as, in Sri Aurobindo's terms, is the supermind. And causal, you see, the karana, karana sharira or karana samudra and all that kind of thing, is these are all references to the supermind. That is the causal plane. That is where causation begins, one may say. But what some other sort of description is saying, what exactly they mean, causation can also appear elsewhere. Like what he's talking about, mental causation, that is also possible. But what exactly the nature of the experience is, I don't know. So I'm not in a position to really comment on it.
Actually, that helps tremendously, believe it or not. And as an extension to that, the astral would be what in Sri Aurobindo's terminology?
Astral, you know, I mean, the term astral has two possible meanings. Again, it's a little relative, and different people have used it differently. In Sri Aurobindo's terminology, astral could either mean subtle physical or can mean vital. So these are the two sheaths, the vital body and the subtle physical body, that operate closest to the earth. And either of these have been termed astral in different kinds of occult sort of literature.
Thank you, that's very helpful.
Okay, and since that quote has been put up, let me read it out and comment briefly on it. Here the mother says, "This evening the divine presence, concrete and material, was there present amongst you. I," here she uses the first tense, "had a form of living gold, bigger than the universe, and I was facing a huge and massive golden door which separated the world from the divine. As I looked at the door, I knew and willed in a single movement of consciousness that the time has come, and lifting with both hands a mighty golden hammer, I struck one blow, one single blow on the door, and the door was shattered to pieces. Then the supramental light and force and consciousness rushed down upon earth in an uninterrupted flow." Now, here, a number of things are being said. Firstly, it is a state of experience in which exactly the what is referred to as the triple transformation has been achieved and is being expressed. It is the I, the individual, the psychic being, that has firstly known itself to be the entire cosmos and greater than the cosmos. That, you see, I had a form of living gold bigger than the universe, and this idea of form of living gold, and again, concrete and material, are related to a materiality which is spiritual, a spiritual materiality. And this is the supramental reality. In other words, she is experiencing and describing her state of experience. I believe it's a very simple, straightforward, matter-of-fact, phenomenological description of her experience. And we may think about it in terms of philosophy and relate it to what Sri Aurobindo is talking about in his yoga works, but if we are to take it as true, then it is just her state of identity of what is described as the triple transformation. And this notion of knowing and willing in a single movement of consciousness is again a characteristic of this supramental consciousness, which is known as the knowledge will. Normally, there is a distinction between knowledge and will, a hiatus, as it were, between knowledge and power, which does not exist in supermind because it is its own self-conception. As he was pointing out here, real idea is not something which conceives and then waits for something else to realize it. It conceives its own self-realization. Therefore, its knowledge is its will, because it is power of existence that it is, you know, manifesting. It already, whatever it is manifesting, is already existing. And therefore, it is only a certain kind of form, temporal form, that this manifestation is taking. That's why this knowing and willing, interestingly, is very closely related to time. It is related to what she says, the time has come. As soon as that knowledge is there, that act manifests. And that act is basically the act of the precipitation of supramental consciousness into earth consciousness. So within supramental sort of, you know, I mean reality, this is an eternal event that always exists. But within temporality, it manifests that at a certain point of time as an interruption of the order of ignorance. And this is the interruption that takes place. That is basically what is happening in this description.
Is there 956 event?
Yes, Vince.
I think in another place she talked about that same experience and mentioned that it didn't have much effect upon people.
Yeah.
It must have taken some time.
It is definitely, she says that when she came out of that meditation, she thought everybody would be flat on the ground. It would be just too powerful. But as a matter of fact, hardly anybody even knew what had happened. It's a very, very interesting comment. And people usually take it to mean that, you know, how sort of, you know, unconscious normal humanity is. But I think it's a more profound comment than that. It's a comment about the gulf of experience between her own experience of these things and her own physical experience of these things, her identification with the material cosmos and her identification with these inner states. There is a gap somewhere. That is the reason why it doesn't percolate. And she mentions this at places as well, that at a certain point, it becomes the experience of the yogi himself. What is the degree of identification with the cosmic sort of reality and the material plane? How much power can be brought into it?
Do you think it also means there's something about effort there, individual effort?
Yes, undoubtedly it is there. Yeah. Undoubtedly it is there. Because you see, the whole idea, I feel, of particularly the phase of yoga when Mother and Sri Aurobindo were alive in Pondicherry was geared towards gathering certain representative samples of humanity around them that would aspire along with them, that would be co-creators of this reality, that would in a sense sort of be ready enough for this to happen. But to what extent that happened is unknown. The mother has many pessimistic statements about the degree to which that was possible. And you know, to some extent, even Sri Aurobindo's poem A God's Labor is talking about that, about the fact that he's left that manifestation, that that manifestation was left somewhere in the inner occult world, because the roots were not deep enough, as he says. That in a sense, you know, humanity was not ready enough. I mean, either they didn't make effort enough, or they were not receptive enough, or somehow much more time has to pass, or maybe we really need to intensify the aspiration and arise at a need. Because unless the need is there, and there's a place where the mother says that unless the need is there, and she talks about it as the need to know. She says the need to know is tremendously lacking. And unless that is there, the aspiration will not intensify.
Yeah. But I remember her description of Pavitras passing, and her saying that he was much, he evidently was further along than she thought to have died in such a way.
Yes, I remember that, yes.
Yeah.
Pavitras passing, somebody passed away.
I'm not quite sure of the point I'm trying to make, but all that, some people were very, you know, together,
yes.
Really.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
I think the inner condition of many of the people that were with Sri Aurobindo and the mother were far beyond normal humanity. I mean, they really did.
Yes.
Sort of. But you see, there is another thing that's the whole thing about the inner and the outer. That, you know, I mean, this is a very complex yoga in which one may make a lot of strides within, and still there may be big gaps with the outer consciousness. That's why keeping pace with the outer consciousness, constantly trying to give it a solid basis, is very important in this yoga.
Right.
So the Vajrasattva, could you talk about why that percolation, I mean, that gulf exists, that even though inwardly a particular sadhak might have made a lot of progress, it hasn't percolated outward? And
well, there may be a variety of reasons, but ultimately it is a question of you know, that evidently there is such a gulf. It's just an existential reality that you know, the world consciousness, because you see, from a certain point of view, the closer you come, when we enter into meditation, individual existence is very heightened. And ultimately, when you go deep enough, you can know yourself as a reality which is independent. And then even further, one can know independent universal principles. But when we come into the material existence, the closer to the surface we come, our reality as an individual is conditioned by the world. We are constantly taking on persona that are ultimately intersubjective. You know, what you are, when you talk to a certain person, you may yourself not prefigure. You are becoming somebody. You are just as we wear clothes. We are made to actually occupy certain forms of consciousness in our interactions with the people around us in the world. And it is under those conditions that universal consciousness acts, and we have to make a tremendous effort to bridge the gulf between the inner reality, which is independent and individual, and this sort of conditioned reality of the outside.
Interact with. Yeah, thank you, Devashishita. So yeah, it seems that bridge between, I mean, that inner consciousness and the outer, I mean, the gulf is really, really wide, that we cannot just bridge it easily, correct?
Yeah, it isn't easy. You see, also, I mean, it's not for me, because these are very complex things. There are many kinds of angles to these things. But you see, the mother has sometimes talked about the fact that she created a kind of sheltered atmosphere in Pondicherry. She gave people what they needed to make spiritual progress. But in creating such a sheltered atmosphere, certain things were also lost. That is the ability to be conscious enough of universal forces of the outside world. And people often took for granted the shelter or the sheltered form. And that may also have contributed to this sort of insensitivity at a certain point to the tremendous need for universalization and understanding of the gulf between the outer and the inner.
So so it seems that, I mean, you begin to wonder whether there is any reasonable chance of bridging that at all, right? Because even with those circumstances, people seem to have, sadhak seem to have had more than they could handle, so to say. Because, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one never really knows. You see, there's no really simple answer to this question. Ultimately, it boils down to, it's an individual adventure for every one of us. It's untracked in a sense, what conditions somebody has experienced before us and what they made of those conditions are something that totally different from what is given to you and me and what we have to make of it. Also, we don't know what are the conditions of help or hindrance that are given to any person and to us. So there is really no answer to the question. I mean, the question about whether we are doomed to failure or we have already been written into the victory is something which I think one of the prerequisites of this yoga is to cast aside that kind of thinking.
Yeah,
because that already is a sort of a hindrance. It preconditions our approach and casts some kind of a, you know, expectation which we have to get rid of.
Yeah, true. Thank you, Devashista. Very nice.
Would the whole idea of, and you mentioned this ages ago and I can't really remember what you said, but the whole idea of immoral gurus fall under this conversation?
Immoral gurus would fall under which conversation?
This whole gulf we're talking about, inner, outer.
Well, immoral gurus in that sense, absolutely. I think you're very right. I just got the point that you're trying to make. Yes, absolutely. I mean, in the sense that depending on what is considered realization is our achievement. It may be perfectly, I mean, this is a point Sri Aurobindo himself makes with regard to Ramakrishna, who apparently speaks about some yogi who, was moving around with two prostitutes in Dakshineshwar. And he says, what kind of a yogi are you? And he says, well, I've realized the advaitic consciousness within. It doesn't matter at all what I do with my outer life. And Sri Ramakrishna kind of comments saying, in that case, I spit upon your advaita. And Sri Aurobindo sort of jokes about it a little bit and says, but nevertheless, if he had that particular kind of understanding of spirituality, he was perfectly justified in what he was doing. So he had accepted that gulf, if you want to call it that, that there is no need that everybody, takes an integral approach to spiritual realization. So it depends on, what somebody has accepted, whether that is their achievement and realization, and whether they are moral or immoral is really ultimately a question of the individual sort of choice and individual goal.
How do you How does that affect the ultimate becoming, though?
Yeah, it affects the ultimate becoming only in terms of, I mean, see, everybody in a sense in the world is very far away. Most people are very far away from the spiritual reality. Ultimately, it does, of course, have a negative effect, because you know, if somebody can extend a spiritual realization into the outer plane, that helps a lot in you know, eventually making it possible for others to experience the same.
I think also that someone can mask the fact that it seems to others that someone who has realized something, they assume that because they've realized in that one area that they're good people and they can, you know, that they always do good or want to do good. And it isn't quite the case.
That
realization of that person isn't integral, and they can be low realized, still quite low in other areas. That's been my experience.
That's very true. I mean, actually, that is very true. I mean, this is part of the tremendously sort of widespread amount of misconception that exists around so-called spiritual people, gurus, etc. There is a sense that if one is in some way expressive of some consciousness slightly out of the ordinary, that either on the one hand people may feel that they're crazy, or on the other hand they may feel that they're all divine. You know, they're right people, perfect, you know, capable of only good, etc. And then they do something, and then people get tremendously disappointed, and you know, all that kind of thing. So, integral sort of realization is a very kind of you know, distant goal, and it's very difficult to hold people up to that kind of a standard from the very beginning, or even at any kind of intermediate stage. You know, that's part of the reason why, you know, even in terms of the disciples of the of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, it is not right to kind of make comparisons between them and Sri Aurobindo and the mother. It's a self-defeating exercise, because at some level or the other, they are grappling with human problems. And in fact, Sri Aurobindo and the mother also grappled with human problems in their journey to the kind of state of consciousness they achieved.
So the people who are holding, who are looking at these beings who we assume to be very good, okay, because they realize the area. How do they deal with the inconsistencies that they are clearly observing?
Well, say for example, if they are looking for a certain kind of realization, then if the realization is to be an integral realization, and they find that this person does not express that integral realization, then that is evidently, there's something wrong with that, accepting that person as a teacher or whatever. One can still learn certain things, but one can, you know, take these people with a pinch of salt, realize the fact or recognize the fact that, you know, they're also journeying to a goal which is pretty distant. On the other hand, if they're looking for a realization which these people have, then it should give them room to pause and wonder whether it is a worthwhile realization or a complete enough realization. And if they still feel so, then they should ignore those other things and go for what they can get.
That's very important. Are you on? Is the person on any level colluding, if you like, if that's the word, with the other person?
Yeah, that could be happening. Very, very much so. That could be happening.
Is it like saying, okay, I see this inconsistency in that person, and by accepting it, I accept that inconsistency within myself and my sadhana?
That's very possible. That's very possible. And also there is the fact that, there's often kind of this, as Vince was saying, jumping to this kind of conclusion that this person is divine or this person is godlike or whatever. And therefore, whatever the person does must be the leela of God. You see, have you come across this? I mean, this is pretty yeah. common actually with most sort of dubious gurus. Their disciples stick around for a long time, sometimes for a lifetime, and justify inconsistencies in terms of leela. They say that these were all the divine leelas of this particular person, and I was fortunate to, witness this or witness that or whatever. So these are all, you're right, these are all forms of collusion. But then, when we use the term collusion, we are also creating a certain psychological standard. We are saying that they should live up to this particular standard. Of course, it's a tricky issue because criminality is also involved. Moral standards are not merely individual sort of choices, but have their impact on society. So, to some extent, they are colluding.
Thank you.
Devashish, this is slightly off topic, but I was trying to understand this statement, or the creation as the creation of delight of, as opposed to delight of existence, basically desire of individual soul. I don't know much about Islam, but what is, can you comment a little bit about Islam's view of creation? Is it a creation of a individual's desire, or does it lean on that side, or just want to understand how does it see that? How does Islam see this?
Islam doesn't see it as the creation of an individual's desire, but Islam has different kind of dualism active in it. Though there is a supreme God who is all-powerful, the God is a creator God. In other words, this manifestation of a material universe and the condition that we find ourselves in is a eternal condition. There is no evolution here. In that, it shares its thought, its sort of ideas with Christianity and with Judaism, that there is basically everything is kind of already fixed, and the creator has planted all these things over here. So it is not really, as it were, a kind of a self-conception, but a creation in which God sets himself up as the ruler of this world with creatures whose duty and place is to worship and adore this God, and experience the beneficence of this God. That is their conception. That is, God has created this world to sort of express his power of goodness, beneficence on the creatures of the world.
So there is no concept of either of them, like delight of existence or the egoistic enjoyment, neither of them is present.
You may say that, you could say that to some extent it is not individual will or desire. It's a mixture of the two, because delight of existence is a kind of a creative self manifestation. While desire for some kind of a state, here you could say that whatever this God reality is, desires to, be father and mother, as it were, to the universe, or to the creatures of the universe, and therefore creates creatures. Something along those lines.
Debashishta, can we just rewind back to the very first part of this class, that you were saying that I think there was a question on Buddha's achievement. Has it affected the consciousness of the individual? So I remember this line in Savitri which says that one man's progress can save the world.
Can still save.
So that one man was Ashwapati. So is that important or what is it?
Yeah, it is very important. But that is exactly the point he is going to make, which is that until and unless these separate realities, individual, cosmic will, supreme or transcendent being, are not realized simultaneously to be the same thing, then that does not make any difference. The cosmos has an independent reality and forms the basis of any enduring change in the human experience. The human individual has to, in a sense, consent to the condition of experience which he or she is going through and can also participate in its overcoming. But both of these realities are ultimately partial manifestations of a supreme reality that has, of its own delight, become these things. And therefore, the identity with of all these three can create the condition for the, change, cosmic change, individual change, change of experience.
Mm-hmm. And the other kind of change that we talk about, which is that somebody holy has come in the room and you feel a peace. So that's all in the very prakritic level, right? I mean, let's say external level.
Not only external level, it is temporary because it basically has a certain amount of temporary effect on the constituents of nature. So because there is a connection between a higher consciousness and a lower consciousness is modified to some extent. It is another and more temporary sort of phenomenon similar to that of the appearance of life or mind in matter. It modified matter, but matter did not change or get transformed as a result. So there will be felt some influence due to these particular kind of beings, etc. But that influence only has effect in terms of letting us know that something exists which is desirable outside of our condition. Mm-hmm. But it cannot leave any enduring change.
So that's why when Sri Aurobindo talks about doing good to the world, altruism, he points out that you have to first do your own sadhana and that is how you can help. But that help part will come much later.
Yeah, absolutely. One can, of course, take that also as one sadhana. This is the approach Christians take, or the approach that Vivekananda took in another way. One can do that, take that as the sadhana, but not mistake the fact of doing charity as sadhana. One can make the field of work that of, sort of charity or etc. But be careful not to mistake that to be spirituality.
Mm-hmm. And also not to think that you are making a permanent change on other people's life. If they don't have their own aspiration, it is not going to work.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So can we relate collective yoga to this? What exactly collective yoga means?
Well, collective yoga idea has become kind of important only after 1956. It was always important. Sri Aurobindo has also talked about it, but it becomes much more important later after supramental manifestation, partly because of this cosmic reality. You see, if cosmos has a certain kind of reality and somebody has done something, you're talking about one man's perfection yet can change the world. You see that whatever has been done by that one man or by those two people has ultimately resulted in new conditions to appear in the cosmos. But now the problem is that, you know, this is what we've been discussing all along. What about the individuals? Are they ready for it or not? And here it is not merely individuals one by one, but social conditions that have to change. You see, you have to create a kind of a life, not just individual, you know, experience instruments, but create the conditions of life. So conditions of life can only be created if a number of people give an opportunity to some higher power to manifest through them in their interactions, in their, you know, sort of collective manifestation, expression. That is the importance of collective yoga. And ultimately, collective yoga is an opportunity to move from an individual condition to a condition of unity with larger and larger sort of, you know, kind of consciousnesses. So your mother says that if each individual in a group can experience themselves to be the entire group, so that they can actually, you know, identify with every other person in the group, that is a certain kind of an experience in a symbolic form leading towards an even greater experience similar to that of the supramental experience. These are intermediate forms. Collective yoga offers or affords the opportunity of certain intermediate forms of spiritual experience, which otherwise would be very difficult to have in this transition to a supramental life.
Oh, thank you very much.
Can't we practice that here in this group? Or can we?
Pardon? What's your question?
I was just wondering, is that something that you can begin to experience as part of this group that we're in?
Well, what happens, you see, the whole idea of collective, collectives, in a sense, gather some kind of an identity over time.
Yeah.
But collective yoga really has to manifest itself to some extent on all these planes, mental,
yeah,
vital, and physical. So to some extent, you know, I mean, a collective yoga is possible, most possible in locations like ashrams and communities.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it is possible to some degree. It is not necessary for people. In fact, that this kind of community life brings its own tremendous difficulties. It is possible to some degree to have experience of collective yoga living not in proximity also. And maybe in some ways, it's even a greater opportunity. So, you know, in today's world, all these categories are getting quite sort of, you know, flexible. Plus.
Yeah.
The Vashishtha, towards the end of the book of The Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo talks about this, the group of Gnostic beings, right?
Yes. There he is talking about Gnostic beings in terms of people who have realized the supramental consciousness, then forming this kind of collective, you know, reality. But the mother is saying that at this point of time, the pressure is very strong. Even before that happens, and individuals, before they can achieve individually the supramental consciousness, to simultaneously work on developing collective consciousness. That's one of the kind of changes that she has sort of made to some extent to what Sri Aurobindo has written there.
What did you say, Dibhashita, that before the individual becomes perfect, he can try to be collectively perfect or something like that?
No, not collectively perfect. Simultaneously with individual progress towards supramental consciousness, development and growth of collective consciousness should also take place. Because supermind is already here, looking for instruments.
Mm.
And these are at both levels, individual and collective level. So we should open ourselves to both forms of yoga, in other words.
I see. So, but is it even pertinent to compare the fact that the individual usually runs ahead and the collective drags him down? So, or it is just yoga in two different lines and we should not compare the two?
Yeah, it is yoga in two different lines, and comparison is also possible. What you're saying is very true, but maybe that is also part of the condition of that progress. That, you know, maybe that will happen, but to what extent can we overcome that? See, that also becomes a challenge.
Mm-hmm. So if some movement in you is trying to write off collective yoga, that it gets a little disgusted with when there's a bunch of people and everyone is, there's lack of harmony. So does that mean that inside you there is actually lack of aspiration towards the second line of progress?
No, not at all. In fact, one has to be very clear about something. Collective yoga is not a compulsion just to do yoga with a number of other people.
Mm.
There it is something, again, depending on the state of one's consciousness, there are collectivities and collectivities. You know, you have to find and create your own collectivity. There has to be, kinds of consciousnesses that have affinities and with which you can grow. So, just because happen to be a bunch of people interested in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, you have to develop an aspiration towards being harmonious with them, is not necessarily an ethical injunction in this yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Growth of the individual and growth of the collective need to go together. And one is perfectly justified in seeking out members with whom to grow or to develop collectivities that are conducive to a certain kind of an expression of individual progress.
Thank you very much.
Shall we end today?
Yes.